You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 6th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
How's everyone doing?
Oh, great.
Pretty good, Steve.
Wait, don't we get a today is from Evan? What's going on?
Today is most notably recognized as Hiroshima Day, the day that the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, killing about 70,000 people.
Okay, well, I wouldn't have asked if I knew it was going to be so depressing. I thought you were going to say it's known as the day before Randy's birthday.
That's right. August 7th is Randy's 80th birthday.
Right.
So happy birthday, James Randy.
80 years young.
80 years, yeah, absolutely. Still vibrant. Randy will be on later in the show to talk about some big news from the James Randi Educational Foundation, the JREF. So we'll have that a little bit later on in the show. But first, some news items. Although, Evan, did you have an alternate event to talk about today?
Today in 1926, our beloved Harry Houdini performed his feat when he spent 91 minutes underwater in a sealed tank before escaping.
91 minutes? Why, that sounds almost impossible.
Something tells me
this was a trick of some kind.
Of some sort.
It's often referred to as his greatest performance. So, Harry Houdini.
Excellent. Quick follow-up to start with. We had talked previously about the ashes of James Doohan, who played Scotty on the original Star Trek series. He passed away, was it a few years ago now, right? And he was to have his ashes blasted into orbit around the Earth. The first time they attempted this, the rocket failed, but they were able to recover his ashes as well as the couple of hundred other people's ashes who were on that rocket. Well, just recently, another attempt was made to put his ashes into orbit aboard the Falcon 1 rocket, which is made by the SpaceX guys. And unfortunately, the rocket exploded over the Pacific, scattering James Doohan's ashes across the Pacific, and they are unrecoverable.
Why?
Other person's ashes who's also associated with spaceflight? Who's on that same rocket?
Edgar Mitchell?
No. A little premature. But another astronaut, Gordon Cooper.
Oh,
Gordy Cooper's ashes were on that same rocket.
Nobody's going to give us a Scotty accent?
I'll do it.
I can't hold it together.
I was going to say...
It was so obvious.
You guys excel at the obvious.
I was going to mention that the notes that Steve sends us with these topics has this as news item one, and as his title, Steve puts... The engine cannot take it, Captain. So I thought I was laughing when I saw that yesterday.
Poor Scotty.
Well, such are the perils of spaceflight.
This is
a bad track record for the Falcon rockets.
Yeah,
this is the third one to blow up.
Disconcerting.
Still, plugging ahead with 4, 5, and 6, but track record so far isn't so good.
Well, at least they're practicing them with things like remains and ashes and not people. Living people.
The next news item is another solar power breakthrough. We seem to have these almost every couple of weeks or so. But this is a different kind of breakthrough, not dealing with solar cell technology, but with the ability to store energy gathered by solar power.
Which has always been the biggest hurdle, right?
Yeah, it really is. As I was reading it, when I knew there was a solar breakthrough, I was reading it thinking, what percentage are they up to now? And then they started talking about storage, and it's weird how I hadn't focused on storage in a while, but it was definitely one of the really big weak links in solar energy. You've got the production side, and then the storage side of it was lacking. But MIT kicks butt again with probably one of the biggest breakthroughs in this field in a long time, which could greatly accelerate the transition to carbon-free energy sources. The team at MIT, including lead author Daniel Nocera, who is the Henry Dreyfuss Professor of Energy at MIT, developed a process inspired by photosynthesis to split water into oxygen and hydrogen. The oxygen and hydrogen can then be stored into a fuel cell for use at night or to power your car or whatever. The key is that the process is not expensive and difficult like conventional electrolysis. We've had electrolysis for decades now, and so there's nothing new about that. But the key thing is a catalyst that he and his team developed works at room temperature in neutral pH water, and it's easy to set up. I mean, those reasons alone is really the main reason why this is such a huge breakthrough. Nocera said that it's because of this that's why I know this is going to work. It's so easy to implement, he said. And what really struck me about this article, and a lot of the other articles I read about it, was the genuine, the optimism coming out of these scientists was just incredible. Nocera said that this is the nirvana of what we've been talking about for years. Solar power has always been a limited, far-off solution. Now we can seriously think about solar power as unlimited and soon. Also, James Barber, professor of biochemistry at Imperial College London, a leader in the study of photosynthesis, said that this is a major discovery with enormous implications for the future prosperity of humankind. Now, predictions, Nocera thinks that within 10 years, people may be able to run their homes in daylight using photovoltaic cells. With extra solar energy could then be used to make hydrogen and oxygen to power their own household fuel cell. And electricity by wire from a centralized location may become a thing of the past within, you know, in a decade or so. It might be a little optimistic, but it's so rare that scientists get this so effusive with their optimism.
Not since Pons and Fleischmann. But, it's a little hyperbole. I mean,
yeah.
But and I think that it would require other advances in solar technology before we're all running our homes off of solar. It also depends on, you know, where a part of the world you live in, what the weather is like, et cetera,
right? And,
et cetera.
And they do say that there is work to do, but they really don't see any major impediments, and they think that other scientists can just take this work that they've done and just run with it and just improve it and tweak it and improve it.
But this is you're right. This is an often neglected aspect of solar technology. You know, people focus on the cost and efficiency of the solar cells, the solar panels. But the big problem with solar is that you gather it during the day when energy usage is typically at its lowest, and there's no sun at night at the peak electricity hour. So any solar system has to have some way of storing the energy. And if you have big, expensive, inefficient batteries, that's often a huge weak link in the system. In fact, I remember the Scientific American article that did this, the huge thought experiment. I mean, could we have a huge solar infrastructure within 50 years or so? And one of the biggest problems was, well, how are they going to store all the energy gathered by all the solar cells? And they talked about compressing air under the ground and somewhat questionable methods, you know, of storing the energy. Whereas if they just had a big hydrogen factory that was solar powered, you know, that would solve a lot of problems. So this certainly has a lot of potential to make solar much more technologically feasible in the future. But again, as always, it's hard to predict technological progress.
Right.
We'll just have to see how it plays out.
It's not just that. It's not just the solar energy. I mean, you could tie in wind, geothermal, or any other carbon-free energy production method. So it's anything that produces electricity you can then use to create the gases and then store in a fuel cell. So it's not intimately tied to solar. I mean, it melds beautifully with solar energy collection, but you can also apply to anything that generates electricity.
Yeah, that's a good point. Another little follow-up story, this one on China. So we're recording this on August 6th. And the Beijing Olympics will open on August 8th, 8:08 at 8 p.m.
At 8:08 p.m.? No.
Because 8 is a lucky number in the Chinese culture. That's why they're started on this date.
No, they've never been wrong. So.
So by the time you're listening to this podcast, it would have already had opened. Well, while we're recording this, it's a couple of days before the start of the Olympics. And the big question is, what's the weather going to be like? Well, the Chinese are very concerned about the weather. And they have the Chinese have the largest ongoing weather modification system in the world. And they have massive artillery set up around Beijing, ready to launch weather modifying or rain-making material into the clouds.
Well, they spend $63 million a year on the program, and somehow they claim that the program is worth $1.71 billion a year to them, I guess by the claimed benefit of them modifying the weather. And then some of the basic stats on the program, they have 37,000 people that work in the program. They have 7,000 artillery guns. They have 4,700 rocket launchers, and all of them work in tandem across the country along with meteorologists and radar stations to pull off whatever they're trying to do at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the claims that they make is that they can produce rain for crops. They also say that they can ward off damaging hail and actually weaken lightning storms. This all just sounds kind of out there to me. I don't know. I haven't seen any real proof, and a lot of meteorologists around the world like don't believe in this at all. As a matter of fact, you know, a lot of people from the United States are being very critical of it. The basic process that they claim is that they seed the clouds, right? We've all heard of this before, and I remember being a kid seeing things on TV where they, you know, planes flying and they're ejecting particulate into the atmosphere to try to, you know, inspire the clouds to collect around that and to rain. But they're spraying different things like dry ice, liquid nitrogen, or silver iodide, and that depends on, I guess, on what they're trying to do. One of the scientists in the U.S. that I read stated that this would only work in a place that's low on air particles.
Yeah,
number one, and number two. Even if you did inspire the clouds to rain, in other words, even if you did add enough mass into the air to have the water, like, you know, collect on those particles, the effect wouldn't be that big. It wouldn't be that dramatic. Yeah. A few other interesting things I've read about this, that this technology has been studied worldwide since the 50s, and two United States states use it, North Dakota and California. And I also read some things about you know, ski locations like ski mountains wanting to test it or use it to help increase their waterfall, which would turn into snow for them, which would help their business. Especially in I'm not saying that I didn't read anything about New England, but in New England the winter has been so bad over the past like 5 or 10 years that all of those businesses are dramatically suffering. And I'm sure that if there was anything behind it, that they would be trying to get involved in it.
Yeah, well, sometimes they claim that not that it makes it rain, but if it's going to rain anyway, it'll rain more or snow more. Like you'll get 10% or 20% more rain if you seed the clouds. The other interesting thing is that China, now as the opening of the Olympics are looming, they're trying to seed the clouds to do something which is even more controversial, and that's to keep it from raining. Hmm. If you use a large particulate, if you seed the clouds with large particulate matter, then that forms large collections of water, which will then precipitate out as rain. That's the theory. But if you use smaller particles, it keeps the water droplets from gathering together and is supposed to keep it from raining. But as you said, Jay, no one's really proven that any of this technology reliably works.
But how could you possibly prove it, though? I mean, isn't that one of the classic problems with this, is that you'd never know what it would have done if you hadn't done it? How could you possibly create an alternate history to show that, oh, well, this is what would have happened and this is what did happen?
Well, I thought about that,
could do a statistical thing.
Let's say that you have a storm that is the size of two or three states. Like I'm just judging landmass by areas that I'm used to. Like, let's say in New England, you know, New York State, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts. Let's say that, like, there's one storm that's covering all those states. If they, you know, experimented on maybe, you know, a couple thousand acres worth of cloud, they would be able to see an effect there where it wouldn't be happening in the other places. So I think it is possible to do some testing.
Well, that's assuming that the rainfall is similar across the entire Thunderhead. There might be, I'm sure there's variation between even different sections of the cloud itself.
You know, Bob's right. There would need to be some repeated testing with statistical analysis, but you could certainly see how people could come falsely to the belief that this works, even if it doesn't. It's kind of like the rainmaker fallacy. No matter what you do, eventually it's going to rain, and then you can credit whatever you were doing.
Well, it's like saying that vitamin C helped you get over your cold.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is that, you know, if you're trying to make it rain, this technology really only works when it's ripe for raining anyway. All the conditions have to be there so that it can rain. Right. It has to be very likely that it's going to rain anyway. You can't seed clear skies or clouds that aren't full with water. So it is kind of a setup for sort of a false impression that it works when in fact it doesn't. But some of the articles were funny. They're talking about the fact that, you know, you wouldn't want to be the guy in charge of the weather modification program at this point in time, because the scientists over there are probably under a lot of pressure from the government to do something that they know really is impossible and they cannot reliably do.
And they say that there's a 50% chance of it raining on Friday.
Yeah, I love that.
And remember the last time somebody failed 50%. The Chinese government?
The head of the FDA, right.
They killed the guy.
Right.
So that's right.
If I was that guy, I'd go out partying Thursday night.
Didn't we talk about something like this before? And Perry actually predicted this. He said something about...
Yeah, right.
He says...
Yes, I believe that China will control the weather. Doesn't cooperate. They'll have it shot.
Yeah, that's right.
And they are.
Technically that. They are shooting
my
the weather.
God.
They are shooting
I think
just
we should
pellets.
Be awarded Randy's $1 million in Perry's
stead. There you go.
I agree.
But we'll see. So by the time you're listening to this, you'll know if it rained on Friday in Beijing or not. One more news item. This one, I think, is had the most number of emails in our inbox this week. The Montauk Monster. Several passersby took pictures of what looks like a very strange, bloated and hairless creature washed up on the beaches of Montauk this week. And this has been zipping around the intertubes on YouTube and on multiple news outlets all week.
Gawker.
I know you guys have all seen the picture. What do you guys think about it?
Many pictures, and it's disgusting.
Looks suspiciously like a raccoon.
When I first saw it, I thought it was Photoshopped.
A lot of people did.
Yeah, the first picture looked a little... Like, just definitely the snout area, you know, how it kind of almost had like a bird beak kind of look to it. And I just thought, yeah, mm-hmm. This is definitely a fake.
Some people suggested it might have been part of a viral marketing campaign of some kind, deliberately thrown out there.
You always got to think of that, too, these days with all the attempts at going viral with advertising. But I don't think it was obvious. When I looked at it, I mean, I didn't think raccoon. I thought, okay, here's an animal that's decayed a certain amount enough to make it unrecognizable superficially. But then when you look at some close-ups and you do some research, I think it's pretty much nailed that it actually was nothing beyond a raccoon.
Yeah, my first thought was definitely a marketing scam until I saw someone on Gawker, where the story originally broke. They posted a breakdown showing a raccoon skull that, and they you know, clearly detailed where it had been broken off and how it overlapped what the picture was. So, yeah, looks like a raccoon.
Yeah, the pictures that have been going around, first of all, there's nothing to show the scale, so you don't know how big it is.
Yeah.
If you look closely or at a close-up of the head and neck area, there's fur on there. There's a little tufts of fur left behind, including some raccoon-colored fur. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I agree with Rebecca. In fact, I just looked up a raccoon skull and just looked at it myself really quick. And, yeah, you could see the teeth are exactly the same. And I think what threw people off is that the front of the snout has decayed. And the exposed skull in the front of the maxilla looks like a beak superficially. Mm-hmm. So it looks like a mammalian type creature with a beak, and but the fur is gone because it's been in the water for a long time, so you couldn't see the color of its fur to recognize it, and it's bloated, so it's kind of misshapen. But yeah, we see this in fact quite frequently, the partially decayed, bloated creature washed up on shore that people can't recognize when they first see it and they think it's some kind of a monster.
Well, one of the first guesses I saw was someone suggesting that there's a government animal testing facility nearby on Long Island and that this was some escaped freakish experiment, which kind of plays into the whole fear of science playing God.
Yes, so this is now part of the Plum Island mythology.
Mad scientists somewhere.
Right.
Release. It got away. Get it. Like I read a few different websites about it, and I saw an interview with the three girls who took the picture.
Yeah.
to me, it was pretty obvious that they were trying to, like, mystify it. And then there was, like, some surfer dude who said something like he's got it in his backyard. And then he was like, I saw a video of it, and it was like he had, like, some stuff hanging off this stick. And I'm like, what? Everyone involved with this seemed a little kooky to me.
Yeah, I saw that, too. It seems like they clearly were trying to exploit the episode for whatever they imagine they can get out of it. But there hasn't been anything like DNA analysis or anything definitive like that. Let's go on to a question from email. This I think we only have time to do one. This one comes from Craig Bishop in Lismore, Australia. And Craig writes, "Hello, Stephen and Skeptical Rogues. Okay, firstly, let me do the fanboy thing." Then he goes on to do the fanboy thing.
We like the fanboy thing.
Which I'm going to skip because it's kind of long. Anyway, I have a question for you, which I hope you will be able to shed some light on, as this has been messing with my head since I was a young boy. It is a question concerning the origins of the universe. Yes, just a small matter, which I am sure you can clear up in no time. The question is, when I consider the origins of life, the universe, and everything, when you go back as far as you can go, it seems to boil down to two simple opinions. Either one, matter has always existed, or two, matter somehow has been created out of a complete vacuum of nothingness. Now, I am certainly no astrophysicist, and maybe I am being too simplistic here, but either of these options seem impossible to me, and I have always wondered at the resolution to this problem, if indeed there is one. You may not want to spend any time on this on your podcast, but I would appreciate if you could guide my thinking or tell me where to look in order to get my head around this better. Yours in anticipation, Craig Bishop. Well, I think we can spend a little few minutes on this. I think that Craig is committing a logical fallacy.
Ooh.
I thought about that, Steve, but you're not talking about a false dichotomy or false premise, are you?
I think his premise is a false dichotomy.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Yeah.
But I tell you,
matter always existed, or matter came from nothingness, but it's possible that there's something that matter came from something else, from non-matter, but not nothing. Right.
Yeah.
And it also depends on how you define nothing. It can't be really nothing.
Exactly.
Nothing, you know?
And nothing actually really, there is no such thing as pure nothing really in physics. I mean, you would think a vacuum is pure nothingness, but it's not. Mm-hmm. But before I go into a little more detail with this, I should start by saying that I'm no astrophysicist either, but I do play one on a podcast. now to your question.
What a fine job you do.
All right, let's see. Matter has always existed. Well, that doesn't make sense. Well, the energy of the universe started at the Big Bang. I would have heard about it if the theory was overturned. Number two, matter somehow has been created at a complete vacuum. Nothing. Well, that sounds more plausible, and virtual particles would tend to support that idea. All right, number one, matter has always existed is fiction. Number two, matter somehow has been created out of complete vacuum. Nothingness. That one is science, I think. Wait. This isn't science or fiction, is it? I'm sorry.
You have to take the complete out of there, because that makes it seem like there was literally nothing, and then the universe came into existence. And I think there may have been nothing in terms of what we think of as stuff, right? There was maybe no space-time and no matter or energy as we know it in our physical universe today. But there had to be some quantum kind of thing there out of which the universe spontaneously sprung.
Right. Right. If there was no space, if space-time didn't exist, then that, to me, that's almost a deal killer, because without space-time, I mean, how could anything happen? Without time, how could anything occur? So it had to be something other than complete and utter lack of space-time. But it helps, Steve. What helps me think about this is I try to find an analog to this situation in modern physics, and there are some things that actually make it seem a little bit less than impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm referring to quantum fluctuations.
Yep.
Quantum fluctuations is a temporary change in the amount of energy in a point of space, and the change manifests itself as a pair of virtual particles that kind of just seem to appear out of nothing. Now, these virtual particles are particle-antiparticle pairs that are like an electron and a positron that are created, exist for an extremely brief interval, something on the order of 10 to the minus 43 seconds, I read on one website, which is pretty damn brief. And then they collide and they disappear. Now, mm-hmm. these particles can't be directly observed. That's why you know, they're called virtual particles, and it's because they exist for such a brief amount of time, it's impossible to observe them, but they do affect matter. In fact, physicist Will Lamb discovered a tiny change in the energy level of atoms in 1953. This so-called Lamb shift is caused directly by the virtual particles interacting with the atom, and it's a minuscule contribution, about one part in a billion. But it was an incredible discovery, and it did earn him a Nobel Prize. Now, how does this happen? You know, what's going on here? One way to look at it is through the principle of indeterminacy, or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I'm sure many of you have heard of this. This is the Werner Heisenberg game-changing idea that there's a minimum level of uncertainty in the universe that we can never get around. For example, if you're examining nature at a minute level, there are certain twin variables like position and momentum that can never both be resolved with arbitrary accuracy. So the more accurately you determine where a particle is, the more uncertain its speed is, and vice versa. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Now, time and energy are also obey this principle. They're also these so-called conjugate variables. So a very brief interval of time, it's very precise. You've got this amount of time that these virtual particles appear that's so tiny. It's such a precise amount of time. Therefore, the energy associated with it is very uncertain. So it's within this uncertainty that these particles can appear and then disappear.
Hey, Bob, how about this? I'm going to blow your mind.
All right.
What if our universe is just a virtual particle in a vastly greater universe?
Whoa, dude!
Whoa, The entire existence of
it's
our
not
universe
science.
is that brief an interval in whatever universe, you know, greater universe of which it is a virtual particle.
Let me go over here and take a hit.
Where you're headed is that. Just like the particle antiparticles can be created and annihilated, our universe could be a giant quantum fluctuation.
Well, yeah, and that's what some scientists believe. That's how I thought about it. About the universe. It's just one big long-lived quantum fluctuation. But there's another side to this coin that also kind of helps me think of this in my mind. Is that you think, all right. The energy, these virtual particles are appearing out of some kind of energy that's inherent in the vacuum. So where did this energy come from? And that kind of leads to the question of, you know, what's the total energy content of the universe? Can anyone guess what the total energy content is of the universe?
Zero.
Right, Jay. It's zero. And when I remember first reading that years ago thinking, well, how could that possibly be? But it works because you can think of energy as being both negative and positive. Positive energy are things as the energy of motion and mass, like matter, antimatter, photons, etc. This is exactly balanced by negative energy of attraction, like certain types of gravitational forces and electromagnetic fields, which try to pull everything together. The result is a universe of zero total energy, which means that it came into existence without any input of matter or energy and without any violation of the conservation of energy. Talk about a free lunch. It's the ultimate free lunch, and that kind of leads to the idea that, all right, you can kind of think of the universe as just one big long-lived quantum fluctuation.
And now, Bob, along those lines, what I've read, and tell me if this is your understanding as well, is that one of the concepts of cosmology is that at the Big Bang, that our universe is primarily matter as opposed to antimatter, but actually the Big Bang created a tremendous amount of matter and antimatter, which almost all of which annihilated each other, and that there was this tiny little residue of matter or excess of matter over antimatter, and that tiny little excess matter is our universe.
Yep.
Isn't that right?
I've read similar things.
Wow.
I think it's called charge parity violation. It's just the way that matter and antimatter, they're not perfect mirror images of each other. There's a subtle difference in matter, which caused a little bit of it to be left over after matter and antimatter annihilated itself. So what's left is this bare little dust of this huge interaction of matter and antimatter that just annihilated each other. And here's this little wispy bit of matter left.
So our universe is the crumbs of existence.
Right.
But still, the energy the energy content is exactly zero. So which was interesting that even the creation of the universe itself did not require a violation of the conservation of energy, or maybe even a God. If you think about it, you would think God would just whip it out of nothingness, and he didn't have to do that.
Right, right.
Or she.
Despite what Neil Adams says, you know, because Neil Adams thinks that matter can be created out of nothing because of the particle antiparticle virtual, you know, pair creation.
You guys ever get freaked out when you think about stuff like that?
It's awesome.
You know,
I love it.
You know, here's the one thing that I find really hard to wrap my brain around is why isn't there nothing? Why isn't there, and what would that be like? What would that really mean if there was nothing, no space-time, no quantum fluctuation, nothing?
Right, and how could there ever have been something like that? Because then, without space-time, what could happen? So that's why I think, you know, maybe our universe came into existence like on top of some other type of vacuum, another type of universe that was already there. So that would kind of make the analogy of the virtual particles and things more apt, because it's just another quantum fluctuation within another vacuum, another, you know, vacuum of space time or whatever.
Do you guys think when we have AI, that we're going to be able to make it so intelligent that it's going to be able to answer these questions?
Well, no, it may take millions of years, and the answer will probably be something along the lines of 42.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Don't panic.
I don't know. I don't know if these questions are answerable.
Yeah, Jay, this type of question might have no answer in principle. There's just no way to determine it. Or, who knows, there might be a way. And I remember news items in the past year that kind of gave some hints of a possibility of determining what could possibly have happened before the Big Bang. So it's really hard to say.
But Jay, what you're saying is the singularity, basically, which is once computers become artificially intelligent and their progress accelerates exponentially, that scientific progress can take off. You know, we could have 1,000 years of progress in the next 50 years, you know, because of this sort of self-reinforcing technology where, you know, computers get smarter, which can design smarter computers, which can accelerate scientific progress. That's, you know, Ray Kurzweil's singularity idea.
Well, him and others.
And others.
But yeah, and by definition, once you pass that point of human level intelligence, then all prediction is pretty much impossible, because how do you possibly get into mind of something that's smarter than a human, or about a million times smarter than a human?
Yeah,
that's the whole idea, the singularity, where you've got this veil in front of the future that we can never peer beyond, because it's impossible, because it's like a dog trying to figure out what's going on inside its master's head. It's just not possible.
Rotate the pod, Hal.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Well, we are joined now by James Randi, who has some big news to tell us about the James Randi Educational Foundation. Randi, what's the news?
Well, for some years now, I, as president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, have had my work cut out for me, and getting out Swift every week takes 3 to 4 days of my time, because I try to do a good job if I can. I try to make it as interesting, provocative, and inviting as I can. It's a labor of love, of course, because I really, really enjoy doing it. But I haven't had a chance to get to my books. I've got two books in the hopper. One will be A Magician in the Laboratory, which will be, I think, rather exciting. And the other is Wrong, with an exclamation mark. And that will be equally interesting, but not quite as provocative, I think, as The Magician in the Laboratory. But I've had them in the computer for some time now. That is, all the raw data and the files and whatnot, and bits of this, that, and the other thing that I have to get organized. It takes quite a while to do that properly. And I'm going to have a lot of my time freed up now, because with the change that we've made, it takes a lot of the responsibility off me, and it really saves me a lot of time and labor. The big news is that Phil Plate is now president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. I've sort of gotten bumped up and to the side, so to speak. I guess that's one way to describe it. I am now not only founder, I always was anyway, you can't argue that, but founder and chairman of the board. I don't know what that means technically, but it does mean that I have some authority, and I hope that nobody thinks that I'm backing out or leaving the JREF. Nothing like that is happening, of course. But I am very, very happy to have Phil Plait on board. I've had all kinds of reactions to the appointment, and they've all been very, very satisfactory, very laudatory, and everyone seems to be happy, and I just hope that Phil is just as happy as we are.
Well, with us also is Phil Plait. So, Phil, congratulations, first of all, being the new president of the JREF.
Well, thank you, and I want to thank Randy as well for this. It's kind of funny. It makes me proud and it makes me humble at the same time. So I think that averages out to just, you know, everything being the same. No, honestly, this is a tremendous thing. It's amazing. I guess I can use that. It's, you know, Randy, for so many of us, and I imagine for so many in your audience as well, have known Randy for years, and he's, you know, a personal hero, someone who is cut through a lot of the nonsense in the world and has really put his neck out to make that point when it wasn't either fashionable or necessarily safe to do that. And we all owe a huge debt to Randy. And so even to be invited to give a talk at the Amazing Meetings, the annual skeptical conference run by the foundation, that's always been a tremendous honor. But then to have this happen is beyond anything I could have ever dreamed of. And so I'm thrilled, and I just hope I'm up to being able to work with Randy and continue on with the goals of the JREF.
Well, I must say, Phil, we considered a number of people. When I say we, I'm talking about the executive board. We considered a number of people, but you were always on top, and I couldn't see any way of your name filtering down to the bottom again. It stayed on top all the way through, and it's because your website is admirable. You turn a good phrase, you got a good sense of humor, and you always have interesting and provocative things to write and to say. And I think that's very much in tune with what the JREF wants to have from our president. So welcome to the fold, Mr. President.
Remind me to slip a 20 in Randy's pocket after this interview.
A 20?
So, Phil, was this a surprise to you, or did you see this coming?
Well, I wrote the press release, so it wasn't that big of a surprise. Well, when it happened, it actually, Randy had pulled me aside months ago, and I had not expected this at all. I mean, we had all kind of wondered, if Randy was gonna, I don't want to say pass the torch or hand over the reins or anything like that, but just get somebody to come into the foundation and continue on with all this. And I was very, very surprised when he pulled me aside. I've always been, I'd say, unofficially affiliated with the JREF, giving talks and that sort of thing. But to actually sort of, you know, make it legit, that came as a shock. But I was really honored by that. And actually, this was at one of the Amazing Meetings. So that plane ride home was very contemplative for me, which is unusual because normally I just sleep on the plane. But in this case, I was really trying to think through, you know, what this would mean. And we continued to talk about it over the course of a few months. And we had worked it out. So I think this is the right decision for me to do this, and I'm hoping that it's the right decision for the JREF. But I think it'll work out. We've got a really good crew. We're spreading out as far as areas of expertise. You know, we have magicians and scientists, doctors, and different people we can call on for their expertise whenever something comes up. And I think this is a strong foundation that's going to get stronger.
Well, I must say, Steve, there's something else, another element in here. Phil has barely been in position for a matter of hours, and he's already come up with several very good suggestions and directions in which we can move, and I can see it moving that way, and I'm sort of standing back in awe and just allowing it to happen.
So, Phil, tell us, what are the big plans for the JREF?
Well, we're going to change the name right away, I think. That's the PPAP.
Yeah, right.
That's kind of sounds good, doesn't it? Well, one of the things I want to do is the E in JREF is for education. And I spent 6 years working with NASA grants at a university developing educational materials for students. And so that seems like a really natural thing is to, for example, I mean, this is just one example, would be to create critical thinking curricula to go into classrooms. And we have run into many teachers at the meetings, and they've emailed us, and I've just talked to teachers before who said, you know, there isn't anything like this. I had to develop this myself. Teachers are always starving for material, but what's funny is they're always also trying to drink from a fire hose. There's so much they're trying to do. So you have to create a curriculum that can be inserted into the already existing stuff that they're teaching, but that sort of sneaks in the critical thinking. And I think that, by basing this on what has already been developed by teachers and what we can interject, I think we can actually do this. Show students, you know, where like large numbers can skew your thinking, like with, for example, the lottery. You know, somebody has to win the lottery, and eventually somebody wins the lottery and then they'll win it again. That has to happen eventually. It may take a long time, but it happens. And so putting that sort of thing into a math class, into a science class, I think is a natural extension. I think teachers will go for it as well.
Yeah, there's always a clamor from teachers for you know, ready-made material for science and critical thinking. So I absolutely think that that's a great mission, you know, to aspire to for the JREF and for the skeptical movement as a whole.
And I've been getting a lot of email, as you might expect, over the past couple of days about this, and I've gotten several offers from professionals saying, how can I help? So I love that, from astronomers and from other scientists saying, you know, is there something I can do to participate with this? Is there any partnership that we could put together? And the answer to that is yes, yes we can. So I'm really looking forward to this. Over the next few months, as I settle into this and figure out, you know, what it is we need to do to prioritize. But I think that's a big one. Because that's something that we can do without it taking a huge amount of time or a huge amount of funding. Because a lot of this stuff already exists, and there's already a need for it. So I think that's going to be pretty high up. But we have a lot of other ideas, too. And I'm just, you know, it's been a while since I've been excited to sit down and work on something. Mm-hmm. And this is it.
So what does this mean for Phil Plate personally? So I don't suppose you need to move physically in order to work at the JREF.
Well, I just moved to Boulder.
Yeah, right.
and I'm happy there. So we're going to try this. You know, there's a trend now towards telecommuting and virtual offices, and so we're going to give this a shot and see how it works. We have, like I said, we have a good crew, a lot of experts that are scattered all over the country. We do have the foundation in Fort Lauderdale. Randy is there, and we have people there who are good people. So I think we can do this, and I can do this from home. It'll mean, you know, less time reading other people's blogs and screwing around, which is probably good for me. So that's fine. But I think the fact that I don't have a job, I already work from home. I've already had to teach myself over the past year. I finished a book. It's coming out in October. So I've already learned how to get things done, even though I'm distracted by, you know, the intertubes and the TV and the playing with the dog and the family stuff. So I'm hoping that even though this won't be a 9-to-5 job, I expect it'll be a 9-to-9 job. We can still get this done.
Yeah. Well, I'm living in an age, aren't we all, where communication is so relatively simple. I mean, different devices for communicating. I don't mean telephones or radios or whatever, but just software systems whereby we can keep in touch and be pretty well plugged into one another's activities. Even if we're not in the next room, and it's almost like being in the next room. So this flexibility, I think, allows one to be a president in Boulder, Colorado, and have a general manager in another part of the world, you know, another part of the country. It's really remarkable that we can do it this way, and I think it's quite workable. I don't see any reason why Phil should have to come down to a lower altitude at all.
I agree. I mean, we do this podcast every week in 5 different cities. you know, right now the five of us are in five different cities. I think that's just the skeptical movement is now more than anything else a virtual community.
Well, let me just sum up, if I may. I am so pleased to have Phil aboard. He's always been aboard. He's always been hanging on the side of the ship, so to speak. But he's always been present whenever we needed him, whenever we asked him any questions or made any requests of him. He was always right up front, and bang, there it was. But now that we have a little closer quarters, so to speak, we've given him a ranking, and we may even... Not this is reaching far now. I mean, I'm going all the way out here. May have business cards printed for him that he can hand out, and of course my picture will still be on them. Nonetheless, you know, when we've he may even get the use of the JREF credit card.
Wow.
But that's way in the future. That's right. I see that.
That's a huge mistake. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Well.
Well, Randy and Phil, I mean, this is something that instantly was obviously a great thing to have happened for Phil and for the JREF. You know, I think everyone knew that the JREF is something that has taken on a life of its own and is something that needs to survive indefinitely. And I think that this move, I think, solidifies in everybody's mind that, yep, that's exactly what's going to happen. Now we have, you know, Phil's leadership. And Phil, you know, the SGU looks forward to continue to work with the JREF and with you, and of course continue to work with Randy as well. So from our perspective, we just have, you know, just more to work with now. And I think we're all very hopeful for the future of not only our relationship, but the skeptical movement. I mean, I think things just keep getting better and better, in my opinion.
I see. So there's no pressure there. All right, good. As long as we're clear on that.
No pressure.
It's so easy to say all these trite sounding phrases, but to call this an overwhelming honor is way understating the case. And so I'm really looking forward to doing this. I'm chomping at the bit. And we're going on the cruise to the Galapagos here in just days, and it's going to be a working vacation. We'll be doing a lot of science stuff, checking out the turtles and the birds and the iguanas and all that. But I'm hoping that while we're all there and trapped on a boat together, we can get a lot of stuff done. And I think that there's no reason to wait. You know, let's get rolling. You know, the Sylvia Browns and the Yuri Gellers and those people of the world, they're not sitting around waiting, you know, for us.
Right.
So we need to stay on them and keep dogging them and make sure that the world at least stays semi-rational.
Wait a minute. Let's go back to that trapped on the boat thing. Maybe I'm going to reconsider for
yeah, I'm taking the key to your cabin. You're not going anywhere, dude.
Oh, no, at some point, you do get to go off onto a almost a desert island that if you step out of line, many people die if they wander off the trail even a little bit. So you got that to look forward to as well.
Good. I'm entertaining that idea, too.
Okay.
Well, P.Z. Myers is coming on this cruise. So, you know, if one of us disappears, you know, I think there'll be a pretty... clear line of evidence where that's at. It.
There's a good reason for a riot right there, too.
So thanks again, Randy and Phil. And we look forward to working with both of you in the future.
Well, thank you. Me too. And it's going to be great working with everybody. I can't wait.
Thanks again, guys. Good night.
Thank you.
The following is a small sample of a extended interview that we did with Phil Plait while at TAM-6. Joining us once again is Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer. Phil, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks.
It's always good to talk with you. I think your Wiseman tied you for the most interviews with the SGU, but uh-huh. Today, or was that yesterday?
Well, that's six today. Of one, half dozen of another,
and now,
anyway.
And now, but his record lasted for only a day, and now you've beat him. Now you're back to number one.
Well, considering he's my evil twin, I think it's, we should just stay tied. I'll let you interview him next, and we'll keep it neck and neck. There's actually been a lot of cool stuff going on.
Well, tell us
recently.
All about it.
Oh, man. When a star explodes, what actually happens is there are two different ways you can get a supernova. But the way people always think of it is a right. high-mass star, 20, 30, 40, 50 times the mass of the sun, runs out of fuel at the end of its life, and the core collapses. And this releases a huge amount of energy, which it then dumps into the outer layers of the star. And so the outer layers of the star explode outwards, and that's the supernova. So when the core collapses, it generates a shock wave. It's an explosion, and that eats its way up through the star. And this is energy of epic proportion. We're talking about the amount of energy a star like the sun will put out over 10 billion years, and it's encompassed in this one shock wave that's going to blow out of the star.
Kind
of
like when the Death Star blew up?
Kind of like that, except if you did that 100 gazillion times all at once.
Okay. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, far away.
Luckily,
but we could still see it because, in fact, I'm glad you said that, Billy, because Mr. Wizard's going to go off on that. Supernovae, you know, a single star outshines the entire galaxy for a couple of weeks. So we're talking about, you know, fairly epic events here. So when this shockwave bursts through the surface of the star, it's just releasing untold amounts of energy. And that comes out in the form of X-rays. X-rays are high energy forms of light. So what you expect to see is a star sitting there and you're looking at it and you're doo-dee-doo, it's just living its life. Suddenly there's a blast of X-rays and then the star rips itself to pieces. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, that X-ray flash has been seen. It's never been seen before. It's always just been theoretical. It's one of these things, it's like, We're missing everything but the gun.
It's inferred.
In a murder mystery. You know, it's inferred, but it's got to be there.
Yep.
Wouldn't the very, very first indication be neutrinos? Wouldn't that be first?
Well, yes, that's true. I didn't realize I was talking to such a sophisticated audience.
Of course you are.
I see.
You're on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
And we'd like to welcome Rebecca to this
podcast.
Hello,
Rebecca.
Hey, Rebecca. That's very nice.
Where were you, by the way?
Where did you come in?
I was at a conference, actually. It's called The Amazing Meeting. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's going on right now.
This is the amazing interview.
Oh, well. This is just Phil. Come on.
Yeah, I know.
Don't ever say this is just Phil. This is one of my favorite interviews every time we do interviews.
Just Phil are two words that don't go together.
And I can't wait to hear the other interviews. Like, oh, Dr. Wiseman, you're one of our favorite interviews. Oh, Jay Myers.
I want to get back to your talk at TAM because it's very – actually, I like it. It's a very interesting approach. Rather than telling the audience what we know, you're going to tell the audience what we don't know and emphasize, right? This is cool stuff that we don't know about bodies in the universe, and because that's where science happens, right? And then that's something we're always trying to reinforce because the – anti-scientists are always saying, oh, scientists are status quo and they don't like mysteries and blah, blah, blah. And it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, we
of the
hate
truth.
That. We hate it when we just, you know, it's like, oh, I thought I understood everything about this. Yeah. Now here's some really fascinating, interesting thing about this. Oh, now what am I going to do? Oh,
better
golly.
Cover it up.
Better not let anybody know about this.
What's that famous quote?
Because there's no way I could continue funding on my research if I don't understand it all.
So, Phil, as a scientist.
I'm rolling my eyes. And maybe that doesn't come through in a podcast.
It did. But, it did.
Are you often baffled? Or shocked.
Or perplexed.
Or perplexed.
Well, my problem is I in fact know everything, and I'm letting humanity dribble this knowledge out piece by piece.
You'll never hear Phil Plait is perplexed by this later.
I think I'm bamboozled.
Bamboozled.
Constipated.
When reach for comment.
Leave me alone.
Yeah. Can you tell us, since this will be aired way after TAM, can you tell us like one of the coolest things that we don't know or... Or is that so?
About TAM?
Yeah. No, whatever.
From your talk, TAM is actually run by Freemasons. You probably didn't know.
I'm a Freemason.
There's nothing.
You are, really?
Yeah. Yeah. You're running this?
That's my favorite kind of Mason, because normally I can't afford Masons.
But, I do chimneys.
Yeah.
That's great.
So what is the coolest bit from your talk?
Golly. There's all these different... I show all the different planets. Just point out one or two things. There's a moon of Saturn called Iapetus, and It's screwed up. Iapetus is always known to be weird because it has one half of it's really bright and one half of it's really dark. And that's been known for a long time. Even from fuzzy ground-based pictures, you can tell that. It's orbiting Saturn, and when it's you know, you can actually map out how it's getting brighter and dimmer. So we've known this for a long time. And in fact, Arthur
like
C. Clarke...
cookie.
It's half black, half white. And we've known that forever. Arthur C. Clarke actually wrote that into 2001, I think. So this has been known for a long time. What's really cool is that Voyager passed by this moon years ago and got fuzzy pictures of it, and they weren't very good. But now we've got Cassini there, which is orbiting Saturn and taking all these awesome pictures, passed by Iapetus. And Iapetus, around its, you can actually see the light half and the dark half. We can see it in detail. You can see that it's ice on one side and all that. It's really cool. But going around the equator of this stupid moon is a 20 kilometer high mountain range that goes all the way around the moon, all the way around. And this is enormously high ridge. And it's like, what the hell is that? I mean, that is unprecedented in the solar system.
So it's like a circle around it.
It looks like a walnut.
Oh, okay.
You know, you hold a walnut in your hand,
right.
And it's
a ridge.
It's got a ridge all the way around it, around the center. And yeah. And in fact, I think Iapetus is actually squished a little bit like a walnut as well. But don't quote me on that.
Can't
That's easy to look
up. Can we make some sort of cookie reference? Because I can't follow if we switch to nuts.
There are nuts in cookies.
I was with you with the black and white, and then...
You don't know anything about
walnuts?
She loves nuts.
Nuts?
Yeah, okay.
If I didn't love nuts, I wouldn't be here with you, Lot.
Instantly, the look of painful patience is on Steve's face.
It's amazing.
Yeah, Steve, when Steve, that comes
Steve's
back.
Thinking about, he's thinking, oh, why did we lock that door? Who called Rebecca?
You know what nuts in a wall are called?
Okay, wait, that's another set of jokes.
Well, so the picture comes back, and of course, the pseudoscientists are going ballistic on this. Richard Hoagland's got his wacky theories about aliens building this thing as a spaceship and all this stuff. He's the face on Mars guy.
Is he still
whatever.
Around?
He loves that stuff.
Yeah, he's still around.
Gee whiz.
He actually spoke at a libertarian conference in Denver. But the thing is, what could cause this? Mm-hmm. And one guy came out with this theory that I thought was really cool. This thing was that, well, it was like a giant moon or something that came into Saturn's ring system and literally collided with the rings, and they piled up along the surface of this thing. And I thought, that's just insane. Mm-hmm. That couldn't possibly be right. But evidently, that can happen, but you need a huge number of coincidences for it to happen. But then what they figured out is that, in fact, a long time ago, Iapetus had a liquid interior, and that wound up freezing, and it shrank the surface. But it was being stretched out by the gravity of Saturn. Saturn pulls on the near side of the moon more than the far side, and that stretches it out. The same thing happens on the Earth and the Earth's moon. And so you got this weird tidal bulge, and then as the whole moon solidified, it shrank. But it was also being pulled at the same time, and so it shrank, but you wound up... you can imagine if you took an orange in both hands and left... Well, that's a terrible analogy.
Don't switch to oranges.
Snowball. I know, it's oranges. So if you grab a... No.
snowball, but basically, right?
Yeah, it was like a snowball. Yeah, you put your hands around a snowball and you squeeze it together. You might get a little ridge around the part where your fingers don't touch. And so very, very good, Steve. You should be an astrophysicist.
Done.
Yeah, and in fact, there's probably ice on the moon, so it's a good analogy. Yeah.
So,
and it's like, well, that's just as wacky as anything else, but we don't know. We don't
know
what caused this.
All the non-wacky stuff's been ruled out, right?
Not all the stuff. I mean, there's probably other, I mean, you know.
Meaning,
we haven't ruled out alien spaceships. Yeah, but you know, maybe we want to look at a natural explanation first before we start invoking hyperdimensional aliens who are leaving us a signpost for
all of the known processes that could be going on.
There are no tectonic forces or anything like that that could have done this.
So something new. That's my point. Something new is going on.
Something new to us. Yeah.
To us, right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Right.
And that's, I mean,
that's cool.
Yeah. You know, when we send a $900 million probe to a planet like Saturn, you know, every scientist will tell you this. If we knew what we were going to find, we wouldn't have to go there now, would we?
That's right.
And it's like every picture that Cassini returns is like, what the hell is this? Every time I get one of these pictures in the mail, it's like, I have no clue what caused this.
Remember all the protests about the Cassini probe? Because it was the nuclear material that was on there.
Plutonium or something.
And people were afraid that it was going to explode on impact in the atmosphere. On launch in the atmosphere, it would be raining nuclear material.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, it's Planet of the Apes time when stuff like that happens. You know, and apes evolve from men, and cats and dogs live together. It's terrible, but in fact, that's never happened to any sort of dangerous degree. They have these things called radiothermal generators, but I'm missing a syllable.
Call them RTGs.
They're RTGs, and what they do is they take plutonium and these things create heat, and you can convert that into electricity. And there's some terrifying amount of plutonium on board Cassini, like 20 pounds or something like that.
Wow.
And it could, you know, if distributed correctly, could wipe out every single human being on the planet, but you would basically have to have everybody line up and give them a spoonful of it. So not really going to happen. And NASA happens to be aware, oddly enough, that plutonium scares people, and so they test these things. They shoot bullets at them. They ram them with things at multiple speeds.
I'm glad that's not my job.
That would be an awesome job. That would be so cool.
So in closing,
enjoy the rest of Tam. We'll talk to you when your book comes out.
Okay, so Tam is awesome. Buy my book. We're all going to die because of a gamma ray burst, and Skeptologist is going to be the awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
Thank you, Phil.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yeah.
Yes.
Rebecca, you missed a tough one last week.
Did I?
Yeah, but Bob got it.
I would have gotten it.
Yes, you can always say
that with impunity. I didn't get it. I nailed it.
You nailed it. You didn't. Okay, here we go. Item number one. A new study suggests that the cores of Jupiter and Saturn contain liquid metallic helium. Item number two. By analyzing anatomical and biomechanical information, researchers conclude that the great white shark has the greatest bite force of any animal ever to have lived. And item number three. researchers find that as many as 1% of the population may experience auditory synesthesia. They hear visual flashes or movement. Evan, go first.
Okay, so the first one was that the study suggests cores of Jupiter and Saturn contain liquid metallic helium. Well, this is my first experience reading those three words in the same sentence, liquid metallic helium. Moving on to number two. Researchers concluding the great white shark has the greatest bite force of any animal ever to have lived. How could they know that? I mean, any animal ever to have lived, what, like, that can test the bite force of a T-Rex or something? Something's a bit fishy. I'll move on to the third one. Researchers finding 1%, as many as 1% of the population experiencing auditory hearing visual flashes or movement. Now, we've spoken about this before, not necessarily in this context, but I know we've brought it up before. So I'd say that seems pretty plausible. Something's not sitting right with me with the shark. I don't know how they can necessarily conclude that. So I'll say that the shark one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, the first one about the study suggests the cores of Jupiter and Saturn contain a liquid metallic helium. I agree with Evan. I've never heard of liquid metallic helium. I'm trying to think what would it mean to be metallic and helium combined. I don't know. I've never heard it before, but it sounds interesting. The thing about the great white shark having the greatest bite force of any animal ever to have lived, I've read and heard that it has the greatest bite force of any living animal, but not of any ever to live. And as you guys know, I'm really afraid of sharks, and I'm up on them. I'm always reading about them, and I think I would have read that. So I don't know.
Shark.
I just don't know about that one. And the final one was researchers find that as many as 1% of the population may experience auditory synesthesia. They hear visual flashes or movement. I totally believe that. That makes perfect sense, and I think it is a lot more common than people think. So I'll go with Evan, and I'll say that I think that the fact that you changed is not ever to have lived, but they have the strongest bite force of anything living today.
Okay, Rebecca?
I think Steve is trying to trip us up, because I think that you can tell what the bite force of a T-Rex is. I mean, that's what they do. That's what researchers do when they study, like, the way that the jaw is set up and looking at what the thing eats. And yeah, I think it's possible that the great white could be on the top of the list. So, and Jupiter and Saturn containing liquid metallic helium. I too have not heard those words together. However, I don't think Steve would make up those words together or make up the fact that it's Jupiter and Saturn. So I think that was
the
true
Steve
too.
Is not imaginative argument. I like that one.
Uh-huh. I think it's a good one, personally. So that leaves the synesthesia thing, which I feel is not that common. I feel that fewer than 1% of the population would experience auditory synesthesia. Maybe 1% total experience all kinds of synesthesia or something, but just auditory, I think that's bunk. So I'm going to say that that is the untrue statement.
Okay, Bob.
AKA the fiction.
The liquid metallic helium cores of the supergiants. I don't have a problem with the metallic helium. Actually, for years I've read about the theory that the cores are metallic helium, or was it metallic hydrogen? But the metallic, yeah, I don't have a problem with that. It's a liquid. Having liquid and metallic together seems a bit odd. But I think that's just a subtle tweak on what we've kind of thought for the long time anyway, so I don't have a problem with that one. 1% of the population, auditory synesthesia. The wrinkle here is that they're actually they're hearing visual flashes or movement, and that's an unusual manifestation of synesthesia. Typically, it'd be something like, you know, seeing sounds or something like that. So that's a bit of an odd presentation that it seems. But 1%, I think it's much more than we think. And there's also levels of affliction, if you want to even call it an affliction of this condition. the great white shark having the greatest bite force, yeah, this certainly sounds plausible. They're ferociously strong. And determining bite force, I think, Jay, you mentioned, or Evan, how they could do it. I mean, if you've got a fossil and you've got, you could see what kind of, even though just at a fossil, you could see what kind of muscle was the attachments were, how big it was, how strong it might have been. You can make a real good estimate of bite force, even if you've just got a fossil to go by. But I don't think the white shark is at the top of the list. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay. So you all agree.
Wait, so I'm alone? It's just me?
You're never alone.
It's just me and the great white shark.
That Jupiter and Saturn has liquid metallic helium at their cores.
Wait, Rebecca, you're not alone with that one.
No, Rebecca did the
synesthesia. No, she's alone in
her
choice.
The great white kicks everybody's ass.
Oh, never mind.
You guys doubt the power of the great white. So it's me and the great white versus you suckers. Go, Steve,
okay.
Go.
Right, okay. So, new studies suggest that the cores of Jupiter and Saturn contain liquid metallic helium, and that is science, as you all suspected.
Mm-hmm.
It was previously known or modeled that there would be liquid metallic hydrogen, which is also, according to the same computer models, at the center of Jupiter and Saturn. What the new computer simulation, one of the things that they were that was surprising was that as the temperature goes up, it might prevent helium from forming into this sort of liquid metallic form. But when they computer modeled, they found that's exactly what would happen. So, they said to think of it like mercury, which is a metallic liquid, that it would have that, although it would be darker in color, that it would sort of behave a lot like mercury in terms of its consistency.
Oh, so it takes on metallic-like properties, but I don't know if they should call it a metal, right?
However you define a metal, that's the physical properties that it has. Metallic helium. So it's really an alloy, and they use the term alloy, of liquid metallic hydrogen and metallic helium. But helium was the new bit that they discovered.
Fascinating.
So pretty okay. cool. Let's see, which one should we do next? We'll take them in order. We'll do the number two. By analyzing anatomical and biomechanical information, researchers conclude that the great white shark has the greatest bite force of any animal ever to have lived, and that is fiction.
Oh, come on.
And Jay did hit, you're not supposed to say you've read it, but that's
right.
You did read it correctly, Jay. It is it does have the greatest bite force of any living animal at 1.8 tons of bite force. A large African lion, by comparison, would have a bite force of about 560 kilograms. Huh. So that's a huge difference. Now, the article does say what animal that has ever lived had the greatest bite force. Does anybody know what this is?
Is it the T-Rex?
T-Rex comes in around 3.1 tons. Not that much more than the great white. 1.8 versus 3.1.
Velociraptor. Some whale. Isn't it a whale?
No, it was some like
Megasaurus?
Marsupial lion or something.
No, it's actually
marsupial lion?
An ancestor to the great white, the Megalodon.
That's what I was thinking of. That's
yes, and that is that they come in
I thought that was just the same thing.
Yeah.
That's what
Megalodon, Carcharodon or something. That
Carcharodon,
fish.
Megalodon. Yeah, so this
that's
is just a
wicked fish. You could walk right into its mouth.
Specious shark. View of things. I prefer a holistic
approach
to the animal kingdom.
10.8 and 18.2 tons of bite force for that creature. So that's, three to six times that of a T-Rex.
You know what other animal has an incredible bite force is a Tasmanian devil.
Yeah, for its size.
Overall, it's pretty badass.
So congratulations, guys. Which
Thanks,
means Steve. That researchers find that as many as 1% of the population may experience auditory synesthesia. They hear visual flashes or movement is science.
Yep.
Now, this news item caught my attention right away because
like a flash.
I have experienced this exact auditory synesthesia.
Really?
And I didn't realize that it's never been described before. Synesthesia has been described before. So synesthesia is when one sensory modality leaks over into another sensory modality. So, and it's a brain phenomenon where if you have, for example, visual signals or messages activating or leaking over into parts of the brain that would experience feel, and you could feel what you see. Or sometimes people describe being able to see numbers or things like that, where just different kinds of information are getting mixed up in the brain. But that there has never been any reports or any documentation of auditory synesthesia, of hearing visual stimuli. It's interesting because I've personally experienced this about three times in my life, only when I've been extremely sleep-deprived. Sleep-deprived to the point that my brain really is not functioning well, you know? If you get to that point where you feel so out of it and almost delirious that you're so sleep-deprived.
Every night.
So it's interesting. So
Right now.
It seems like it may be very common, much more common than they thought.
Steve, could that just have been an auditory hallucination?
No, it was so reliably triggered by opening and closing my eyes or scanning my eyes across light and dark fields. It was reproducible.
Was it enjoyable?
No, it screwed up. You know, you realize your brain is not functioning. But they found out that there are people that for which this is the case all the time, that there are certain visual stimuli that will always provoke an auditory experience. Interestingly, it may actually have, in some situations, an adaptive function. There are some things that we experience and remember more reliably with an auditory stimulus than with a visual stimulus. So I just sent you guys a link, and we'll have this on the notes. This is a test that you could do to see if you are an auditory synesthete. And it's essentially, you have to be in a quiet situation.
I like that form of the word.
Yeah. And if as the white dots move, if you hear any sound, then
really,
then you fit into it. So
okay, well, shut up a minute while we try it.
Yeah, let's all try it now. Ready? Everyone has that link. Everyone, be quiet, and we'll all try it.
It said, "Butcher your family."
I guess I'm not a mutant.
What am I supposed to hear?
You're supposed to hear "Stairway to Heaven."
Mm-hmm. Nothing if you're not genetically deformed.
No, I don't hear anything.
So if you think about it. It could just enhance your experience if things made a little noise when they moved across your visual field. That would alert you to them much better than just with the visual stimuli alone.
Yeah,
it reminded me of that joke that Bill Nye said when we were interviewing him that his arms don't really make that noise when he moves them around. It's like, well, but maybe to some people they do. Maybe arms do make a little noise, a swishy noise when you move them around. So that was interesting.
It's like hearing walking around music when somebody walks.
But I am going to contact them and just let them know that I experienced this only with extreme sleep deprivation. I wonder if they get other reports of that. So congratulations, Bob, Evan, and Jay.
You all suck. Go Sharks.
Go Sharks.
That
Go
actually
Jets.
Makes me more scared of sharks. I just realized it.
Yeah. That was the point of that item, actually. Yeah. To make you more
what about land
sharks,
Jay? Are you afraid of land sharks?
No, just sharks that are in water spouts coming at him.
Yeah, that's so, really that. No.
So, that. Jay, do you have a fantasy of like being on water skis and that jumping over, pit of
no,
sharks?
No, I'm a big fan of snorkeling, and I love deep diving, and I go in the ocean. I'm not afraid. I'm a little bit. I'm not going to lie and say I don't like look around sometimes and. Maybe I get freaked out a little bit here and there, but for the most part, I love it, and it's great. And I actually did swim with a shark in Hawaii, in Maui, last year. I knew I was in a safer environment. I mean, if I saw a big great white, I know I would lose my shit.
Oh, great white. Forget
Literally.
It. Game over.
Forget it.
But the vast majority of them are completely harmless.
So, Jay, don't watch any documentaries about the USS Indianapolis.
Oh,
I know all about it.
You don't want.
I know all about it. Yeah,
that, oh,
you know
what? Boy,
I'm not going to.
300 people go into the water.
I directly have fear of sharks because I saw Jaws when I was too young.
Yeah, we were young when that came out.
Yeah, that movie totally freaked me out.
Not just you, millions of
that
people.
That was hardcore for the time.
It definitely was.
That
was
still scary. You watch it today, it's still scary.
Oh, it's
I'm
a
still
great
scared
movie.
Of plastic sharks.
That movie was the really first summer huge blockbuster. It started the whole summer blockbuster craze.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
You know what's funny is I heard someone refer to Jaws as a monster movie, and I never thought of it as a monster movie, but it's a monster movie. It is.
Well, Jay, give us a quote.
This quote is from Richard Dawkins. He's a British ethologist, an evolutionary biologist, and popular science writer. I recently just started reading The God Delusion. That's one of the books I just kind of slipped through the cracks. And he also wrote The Selfish Gene, which is another one of his classic books. So I found a compendious quote. I think everyone will enjoy this one. Science is the poetry of reality.
I love that. That's a good one.
Good one.
It surely is.
That was written by Richard Dawkins.
That's a good thing.
Cold blimey.
Cold blimey, Governor.
Oh, no. Only letters. Steve, before we finish up, I wanted to mention two things, not entirely happy things, but we had the good news of Phil becoming president of JREF. That was great, but it's been a crazy week because we also lost a really great guy and a true skeptic, Jeff Medkeff, a.k.a. the Blue Collar Scientist. He is the guy who named the asteroids after me and Phil Plait and P.Z. Myers and Michael Stackpole, Derek and Swoopy. He's a fantastic guy. He lived in Alaska, and he was a great skeptical activist. And it's a huge loss for the community. And also, just yesterday, I found out that Robert Lancaster, who's been on the show before, he suffered from a stroke. He's in the hospital currently recovering from it. He will hopefully make a full recovery, but I don't know yet. There are posts on both of those topics on Skeptic if people want to log on and give their condolences and well wishes for Robert and Robert's family and Jeff's family. We'll be sending the links to them for them to read.
Well, we certainly hope Robert recovers. Mm. We actually, he was just at TAM 6 with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's such a fantastic guy. Big bear of a guy, always smiling. So, everybody wishes him the best. He's got a lot of support, so I think he's going to be all right.
I do have an announcement as well. So we're working very diligently to find a venue for the live recording that we're doing in September, the first annual Perry DeAngelis event. But it's very difficult to find a venue in New York City. We have some possibilities, but nothing that we've nailed down yet. What we are asking for is help from any of our listeners who is a student at a college or university in New York City, or who works at a museum or library, basically anyone who can co-sponsor the event with us to help us get into a venue. We're looking for the end of September, but we are obviously at this point flexible on the time. We haven't nailed down a date yet. So if it's, October or whatever, that's still fine. So send us an email if you think you can help us out. But one way or the other, we will have a venue within the next couple of weeks, and then we will announce it as soon as we book something. So thanks for joining us once again. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Good episode.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptic.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.